You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the May 2025 issue of Vanity Fair magazine, which features Sebastian Stan on the cover. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's this month's editor's letter from Editor-in-Chief Radhika Jones, with photograph by Norman Jean Roy. The inimitable Marie Brenner has been writing profiles and investigative stories for Vanity Fair since the 1980s, and her interview in this issue with Alyssa Slotkin is an instant classic. Marie started spending time with the junior senator from Michigan back in early December, before Slotkin made headlines, pushing back at Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth and OMB Director Russell Voigt during their Senate confirmation hearings, before she gave the Democratic responses to Trump's joint address to Congress, but just in time to present this sharp portrait as a party searches for its new standard bearers. Slotkin, a former CIA analyst, has all the ingredients for political success, a compelling personal story, a backbone, and a voice, and in her case, principles to boot. Above all, she radiates authenticity, the quality that by definition you can't fake. The thing I pride myself on the most is that I am independently minded, she tells Marie. I'm hard to put in a box, but on social issues, I don't try to tell other people how to live. I don't always agree with my party on fiscal issues, national security issues. But on who gets to be in the club, I have a pretty expansive view of who gets to see themselves as equal citizens. And I never liked the bullying that went on in certain Republican circles. It really bothers me. Another instant classic, Anthony Bresnahan's cover story on Sebastian Stan, who is fascinating as a leading man. His range is tremendous. Who else could pivot from Gossip Girl to Captain America's sidekick Bucky Barnes to a young Donald Trump? Stan comes to acting with an immigrant's history, a kid who threw himself into stage roles because they offered him different ways to envision himself in his new world. His mother, Georgeta Orlovsky, a pianist, fled political upheaval in Romania, first for Vienna, where she established herself, before sending for Sebastian to join her, then to the States. This winter, she accompanied her son to the Oscars, where he was nominated for Best Actor for his role in The Apprentice, the film written by Vanity Fair's Gabriel Sherman, about Trump's rise to power under the tutelage of Roy Cohn. Stan's father had left Romania even earlier, going into exile after having worked to help other Romanians escape government persecution. I have always made the argument that immigrants to some extent are more patriotic than even the people that are born here because they don't take things for granted, Sebastian tells Anthony in reference to his father, words that resonate deeply at this particular moment when our own government is denying even legal immigrants their rights. Here are some of the contributors to this month's issue. Tom Clute, Roman Empire. Contributing editor Clute tagged along with WWE superstar Roman Reigns, also known as Joe NOI, for a day in South Florida before heading to Indianapolis for the Royal Rumble, Clute's first pro wrestling match since he was 12 years old. This story is about Roman Reigns, but it's also about the remarkable staying power of WWE and the way it continues to animate American life, he says. Marie Brenner, change agent. In her 40th year writing for Vanity Fair, Brenner profiles the new Democratic senator from Michigan, Alyssa Slotkin, whose authenticity and passion for public service struck the writer and have struck a chord with voters. Brenner's reporting has been the impetus for 5 feature films, including The Insider and Richard Jewell. Edward Boleg III, United We Stand. Sebastian was great to work with. It's a cool feeling when the talent responds well to the pieces they are wearing, says stylist Boleg, who aims to empower his subjects through fashion while using each look to build a story. Ruven Afanador, in Good Company. For photographer Afanador, preparing a group portrait of famed Juilliard alumni was something like a revelatory experience. It was like working in a laboratory of the arts at its highest level, he says. And one subject stuck out. Once the shoot started, we were all charmed to no end by the brilliant John Batiste. It was a shoot that I will always treasure. Anthony Bresnahan, United We Stand. Bresnahan, Vanity Fair's senior Hollywood correspondent, has covered entertainment for 25 years, and this month's cover star for a significant portion of his career. I first met Sebastian Stan in a Long Beach parking lot being used in Captain America, The Winter Soldier, he says. That was a turning point for him, and now he's at another crossroads. The Artist Way. Multi-talented Esther McGregor finds her footing in front of the camera, by Rebecca Ford, with photos of McGregor at the beach in various styled dresses and fashion looks, by Nick Riley Bentham. I've been acting since I came out of my mom's stomach, says Esther McGregor, but not many people got to see her performances, she adds, since most were limited to her family's living room. My parents never let me do anything on screen until I was old enough to executively make the decision and also old enough to be a human on set, the actor says. My dad grew up on that, so he understands the perils of the dark side of being a young actress. Her father is Ewan McGregor, who knows about the galactic dark side, too, and her mother is Eve Mavrakis, an art director and production designer for films. Last year, McGregor put her own spin on her famous last name in two high-profile movies, playing Nicole Kidman's daughter in the erotic thriller Baby Girl and Tilda Swinton's younger self in Pedro Almodovar's meditative drama The Room Next Door. In June, she'll appear in the Prime Video series We Were Liars, based on the gripping YA novel of the same name, about a group of friends sifting through secrets on a private island off Massachusetts. McGregor plays Mirren, a character she found eerily similar to herself. She's this cheery sunshine girl who has this allure and charm because she's a bit of a weirdo. That tracks, except for the weirdo part. In person, McGregor is effervescent and kind, but clearly feels emotions deeply. She moved from London to Los Angeles with her family when she was 11. Her mother is French, and not only taught her and her three sisters to speak the language, but also instilled in them a worldly sensibility. I rely on my mother quite a lot, she says. She is my rock and my inspiration for a huge amount of myself and my ambitions. McGregor loved drawing from an early age. It was a really good way for me to focus and keep my mind still, and during COVID, started to learn about tattooing through her then-girlfriend. She gave one of her first tattoos to her father of a scarf he'd seen in a dream. McGregor discovered that she loved the craft, both as an art form and a means of making connections. 4 years ago, while a student at NYU, she and a friend opened a women and queer-friendly tattoo shop in New York called Pink Ether. Getting to meet people in this environment, where my social anxiety isn't off the rocker because I'm working, I got to open up so much because it's this true transaction of trust, she says. She still had some leftover energy, though. McGregor was part of an electronic pop duo called French Time, and she has modeled for Miu Miu, Stella McCartney, and Fendi. She juggled all this for about 6 months before realizing it wasn't sustainable, which her friends had predicted. Everyone told me not to do it, and I was like, everyone needs to shut up, she says. Truly, I don't regret it at all because I learned so much about myself and my limits and my boundaries. She stepped back from the tattoo parlor, though she keeps a short list of clients, and modeling, which she realized was not where she wanted to put her energy. It wasn't my passion, she says. I've never been more depleted or tired in my life. McGregor is entirely focused on acting now and is based in Los Angeles, where she lives with her geriatric hairless cat, Azure. She's a French cat. She only, really, only speaks French. After shooting a few short films and starring in the 2022 Amazon Freevee series High School, McGregor booked Baby Girl and The Room Next Door, both of which speak to her affinity for international film. She'd love to make her own films someday. She's inspired by French icons like François Truffaut and Jean-Luc Godard, along with David Lynch's abstract absurdism, but she's keeping her focus on her first love. As long as I'm acting, I'm happy, she says. If things don't work out the way that they're meant to, I'll be writing my own theater pieces and putting them on for five people in my backyard. Here's what's trending. In the cut, the Costume Institute's spring exhibition, Superfine, Tailoring Black Style, explores the black dandy through history, from 18th century expectations to contemporary transformations, while spotlighting the importance of sartorialism. In the photos, Muhammad Ali is fitted for a new suit in London, 1966. Mateo New York cufflinks, Wales Bonner tuxedo jacket, Valentino pants. The House of Creed, Millesime Imperial fragrance, Maison Margiela waistcoat, Omega watch, Salon 1884 coat, Bevel razor, Etro jacket, Harwell Godfrey ring, Kiehl's since 1851 moisture treatment, McQueen dress, Officine Universelle Bully beard brush, Van Cleef & Arpels snowflake clip, Bode House shoe. Also trending, florals for spring. MoMA presents Hilma af Klint's abstract botanical pieces, which juxtapose watercolor blossoms with precise drawings, suggesting the human spirit's union with nature. In the photos, garden variety, Bernard James earrings, self-portrait sweater, Ferragamo scarf, pleasing nail polish and sprouting, Erdem dress, diptych Paris diffuser, Dior beauty blush in 063 pink lilac, Gigi Burris millinery hat, Indris brooch, Cartique research coat, Cecily Bonson jacket, Rosie Asselin tee, Dries Van Noten pants, Loewe sunglasses, Glossier Eau Fleur eau de parfum, Philip Lim skirt, and sheet 4 from Hilma af Klint's Nature Studies, 1919. And this from Maggie Coughlin, To Die For. Photograph by Peter Garitano, Ferragamo soft bag. Soft power takes on a new meaning with this supple handbag from Ferragamo, based on an archival style and reimagined by creative director Maximilian Davis. It's made from pliable, semi-glossy Napa leather, making the soft bag's smooth surface a tactile delight. A rounded form and pleated sides strike a playful balance between fluidity and structure, while a vivid tie-dyed design echoes the joyful unpredictability of spring. Whether this purse is worn with a shoulder strap or with handles tucked inside, its power is undeniable. On to Books, Feeling This, and a full-hearted new memoir, Blink-182's Mark Hoppus confronts friendship breakups and a cancer diagnosis, by Daniela Chirina. In the photo, Travis Barker, author Mark Hoppus, and Tom DeLonge in California in the early 2000s. And if you're feeling controversial in how his name is pronounced, DeLonge does have something on the internet that says, yeah, I pronounce it DeLonge, but I was corrected and told in French it's DeLonge. I feel like I'm supposed to be dead, says Mark Hoppus. Every day after cancer is a gift. It's strange, if not bittersweet, to hear the 53-year-old vocalist, bassist, and founding member of the famously irreverent, chart-topping, multi-platinum, Grammy-nominated band Blink-182 sounding more like a buttoned-up motivational speaker than the beloved pop-punk royalty that he is. But his unruly salt-and-pepper hair and thick black-rimmed glasses act as a reminder that even this skater kid from the Southern California desert, whose music came to be emblematic of everlasting youth, somehow isn't immune to growing up or growing older. I fail a lot, and I still get mad at dumb shit, and I still get depressed sometimes. And some days I'll waste a whole day effing looking at my phone and Instagram when I should be out looking at art and creating and doing fun stuff, says Hoppus. But I really, after cancer, have tried to cherish every day, every relationship. It's made me reevaluate a lot. Getting to this point, as he recounts in his new memoir, Fahrenheit 182, published by Dye Street, co-written with Dan Otsi, has been a journey. Over the past 30 years, Hoppus and his bandmates and longtime best friends, Tom DeLonge and Travis Barker, have been put through the ringer. For three dudes known for getting naked in music videos and making dick jokes on stage, Blink has endured their fair share of traumatic events, from Barker's near-fatal plane crash in 2008 and their producer and dear friend Jerry Finn's death from a brain hemorrhage that same year, to DeLonge's exit from the band in 2015, and most recently, Hoppus's cancer diagnosis. By rock star standards, the fact that Hoppus lived to tell the tale is a miracle in and of itself. But as Hoppus writes, one in a million happens to him a lot, for better or worse. The band's history starts when DeLonge and Hoppus meet in San Diego in 1992. I loved Tom from the first day I met him, Hoppus writes, but it wasn't until after Barker came on board that they exploded onto the scene with their 1999 breakthrough album Enema of the State, delivering coming-of-age anthems like What's My Age Again and All the Small Things, and becoming fixtures of the Billboard Hot 100 and MTV. Over the next decade and a half, the trio made three more studio albums, toured the world headlining venues like Madison Square Garden, and even landed the cover of Rolling Stone. They were bona fide rock stars, so when DeLonge quit the band to pursue his own musical endeavors and research UFOs, Hoppus was devastated. In the book, he likens the split to a divorce, bitter and acrimonious. It brought him right back to his childhood and the feeling of a family being torn apart. Everything was taken away from me, but I didn't want to make Tom out to be a bad person, because he is not. It was just where he was in life. It's a particularly sensitive subject for Hoppus, but trying to write it so that I was fair to Tom, he says, made him come to peace with a lot of anger and resentment. His stage 4A diffuse large B-cell lymphoma diagnosis, an aggressive form of blood cancer, arrived during the COVID-19 pandemic, just as he was about to enter his first session with a new therapist. He writes that the experience was heightened by his pre-existing anxiety, depression, and obsessive compulsions, describing candidly the panic attacks and suicidal ideations he experienced during the pandemic. "When I was diagnosed with cancer, everything else stopped," he says. "I thought I was going to die. There were those one in a million odds again," he thought. But the odds shifted in his favor. First, after learning about his diagnosis, DeLong and Barker visited Hoppus at his house. It was as if no time had passed. No mention of the past, only the future, one where Hoppus was healthy and Blink would make the best album of our lives, Hoppus recalls DeLong saying. "They're my best friends in the world," Hoppus says. After 6 rounds of chemotherapy, which he details in raw journal excerpts, he was declared in remission in September 2021, and the next year they reformed the band for an 18-month trial period. Then they released One More Time, their most mature album to date, featuring poignant lyrics like "It Shouldn't Take a Sickness" or "Airplanes Falling Out the Sky," "Do I Have to Die to Hear You Miss Me?" 3 years later, with one deluxe album and world tour down, they're still going strong. As Hoppus declares in the book, Blink 182, forever and always. Six-pack, poetic novels and lyric memoirs, Plum Grief and Longing by Keziah Weir. Open Heaven by Sean Hewitt. The poet, Rapture's Road, spins a tender, eloquent debut novel. In adulthood, a man returns in place and memory to the village in northern England where as a teen he met Luke, his first love, published by Knopf. Things in Nature Merely Grow by Yuyun Lee. Facts are the harshest and the hardest part of life, writes Lee. After her son's suicides, Vincent, age 16 in 2017, James, 19, last year, the author contemplates the profound difficulty of continuing on. Published by FSG. "I regret almost everything," by Keith McNally. The outspoken restaurateur responsible for such Manhattan institutions as Café Luxembourg, Pastis, and Balthazar recounts a full life. His days as a child actor, glittering New York City nightlife, and beyond. Published by Gallery Books. The Hollow Half by Sarah Aziza. With grace and rigor, the author examines an eating disorder alongside family history, her grandmother's displacement, her father's birth in a Gaza refugee camp, and the swell of her husband's love. Published by Catapult. The Dazzling Paget Sisters by Ariana Banks. Celia and Maman Paget, identical twins born in 1916, captivated the literati from George Orwell to Albert Camus, as captured through their letters and notebooks by Celia's daughter, published by McNally Editions. The Emperor of Gladness by Ocean Vuong. The once hopeless 19-year-old Hai, a would-be writer who never writes and lies to his mom about attending medical school, falls into caring for a Lithuanian widow suffering from dementia in Vuong's newest fiction, published by Penguin Press.
Thank you.
Good Trouble. In the era of Trump 2.0, acts of defiance, big and small, have gotten creative, by Case Wickman. Denied the option to vote remotely or by proxy during parental leave, Colorado Representative Brittany Pederson treks to D.C. to vote against a GOP budget plan, bringing her four-week-old son onto the House floor to do so. Vermonters picket Vice President J.D. Vance's family ski vacation, holding signs reading Vance skis in jeans. Civil servants spam a chat about Musk fork in the road policy with spoon emojis, which administrators later disable. Screens in the Department of Housing and Urban Development offices are hacked to show an AI-generated video depicting Trump licking Elon Musk's toes. The email address for the Office of Personnel Management's HR is publicized. Chaos, memes, and a lot of spam ensue. MAGA granny Pamela Hemphill turns down a January 6th pardon. The now anti-Trump septuagenarian says it's the president's attempt to rewrite history. 8647 begins to appear written on paper money. Its hidden message? A plea to 86, the 47th president's rule. Meta employees restock men's bathrooms with tampons after Mark Zuckerberg removes sanitary products as part of sweeping DEI cuts. Swedish EV manufacturer Polestar offers a $5,000 bonus to Tesla owners who switch to its brand. An Etsy shop sells more than 18,000 anti-Musk bumper stickers to those experiencing buyer's remorse about their Teslas. National Park Service workers at Yosemite hang the American flag upside down, code for dire distress, on El Capitan. Emphasizing legislative double standards against women, Mississippi State Senator Bradford Blackmun introduces the Contraception Begins at Erection Act, which would penalize discharge of genetic material without the intent to fertilize an embryo. After the Trump White House removes a reproductive rights resource page, the skim republishes its content. O Canada performer at the Four Nations Face-Off hockey tournament changes lyrics in response to Trump pushing for Canada to become the 51st state. Artist Diana Weimar and others express their rage by turning absurd Trump quotes into textile art, dubbing it the Tiny Pricks Project. Poetic Harmony, with a poem for deep thinkers at the Guggenheim Museum, Rashid Johnson revisits his archive. In the photos, Untitled Escape Collage 2018, and Rashid Johnson photographed in his studio in 2024. Artist Rashid Johnson has recently let the light in, renovating the ceilings of his Brooklyn studio to flood the space via skylight. A Poem for Deep Thinkers, the largest exhibition of Johnson's work to date, does something similar as the Guggenheim spotlights his multidisciplinary practice over the course of his three-decade career. Filling the museum's Frank Lloyd Wright-designed rotunda, the Career Survey features nearly 90 works exploring themes of self-examination, liminal space, and legacy, and what Johnson calls an investigation of my own experiences and ideas and understanding of the world. The exhibit, which includes black soap paintings, large-scale indoor and outdoor sculpture, film, and video, takes its name from a poem by the late writer and political activist Amiri Baraka, whose presence looms large in Johnson's oeuvre. That poem is an interesting challenge, the artist says of the text, which Baraka performed at the New College of California in 1977, the year Johnson was born. It feels prescient in some respect. He is really, in a sense, trying to hold accountable an educated class of folks and calling into question where their loyalties lie and where their ambitions lie, and questioning their sense of action and their sense of responsibility. In the creation of the show, Baraka's words once again compelled Johnson. Consistently, I'm asking myself, what are the intentions of these objects? What are the goals of this project? And do my actions live up to my ambitions, he says. One of the kinds of really significant transgressions in an artist project is the willingness to self-challenge and the willingness to recognize your limitations, but at the same time, question what is at the center of your project. I don't have, and I wish I did, but I don't have solutions in my project. Throughout Johnson's evolution, his work has remained highly referential, conjuring academics, activists, and authors like Harold Cruz, Angela Davis, Octavia Butler, Toni Morrison, and historical figures including Frederick Douglass and W.E.B. Du Bois. I really don't think of them as archived, resolved voices, he says. I see them as current contributors in my thinking, and their critical positioning and the critical positions that they activated as being spaces for me to navigate and update and explore. Recently, self-reference has become more approachable. Previously, I would have been intimidated to use the soul or God or beauty, he says. There's a different confidence that comes from allowing your own experience in a different way, soulfully, to impact what it is you're making. As Johnson prepares for the exhibition, one wonders, does he write poetry? I did for many years, but not so much anymore, he recalls, sitting back on a sectional under the skylight. I consider now the artworks that I make, the visual artworks, as poems. Such as keeping company with deep thinkers. Thank you. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman. Today's broadcast is in honor of my mother, who was always a voracious reader.